call the Civil Law Committee to order. I'm sorry, I had to meet with a student. I didn't know you were holding up for me to be quorum, so I apologize. Let's first, Representative Juskowski moves the approval of the, what is it, of the February 15th, 2012 minutes. Any discussion? All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Representative Scott, we'll move to your bill. Members, just so you and the audience know, this bill we do not plan to vote on any longer today. We would like to have it explained to us. Comments or additional feedback you could give the author, I think, would be very productive in revising the bill. We've had some feedback given to us, and I think it could be very meaningful for the author and the constituents that she has here to testify regarding this matter. And so I'll be thinking of that as feedback, but I want members to know, generally, I think about an hour we'll try to wrap up the discussion, and sooner if there's no further discussion, but I'll try to, I think about an hour would be suffice. But members to know that there won't be a vote being taken today. So, Representative Scott, do you want to move your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 424.
And where was
there's a DE1 amendment to, or DE2 amendment to get it in the shape that we're going to talk about today.
Representative Scott, we'll make the motion to refer it to Judiciary Committee, recommended to pass and refer to Judiciary Committee, with the idea that we will lay that on the table when we're done with the discussion, but that way we have the right records. Representative Scott makes that motion. Representative Scott, to get it in the shape that you would like it for discussion, the DE2 amendment?
Yes.
Representative Scott moves the DE2 amendment. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Representative Scott to the bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The purpose of the proposed legislation is to add transparency concerning the actions of fiduciaries and provide accountability to the family of the vulnerable adult by correcting certain deficiencies in current Minnesota law relating to civil actions on behalf of elderly vulnerable adults through the following provisions. Requires that a person who assumes the care of a vulnerable adult or is in a position of trust and confidence to an incapacitated or vulnerable adult act for the benefit of that vulnerable adult. Provide standing for interested persons to bring civil tort actions against a tortfeasor on behalf of the elderly person who has been neglected, abused, or exploited by the person that is in charge of their care. Provides that the tort claims survive the death of the victim, so an interested person, in addition to the personal representative of the state, can bring the tort claims, and a claim pending prior to death is not extinguished by death. It provides additional remedies such as disinheritance from the estate, actual and consequential damages, punitive damages, and reasonable attorney fees. And members and Mr. Chair, today I have with me Eunice Smith, who brought this bill to me, and she's going to explain a little bit about why this bill is needed and give a personal testimony of her own situation and what happened within her own family. So, Mr. Chair, Eunice Smith.
Thank you, Representative Scott. Ms. Smith, welcome to our committee.
Thank you.
If you could identify yourself for our taped record,
okay,
that would be fantastic. And please tell us your information.
Okay. My name is Eunice Smith. I'm here to testify on behalf of this bill. And I would like to just read the testimony that I prepared explaining why this is of such concern to me. Okay, elder law attorneys promote the use of estate plans, including powers of attorney, trusts, and transfer of assets, all designed to enable the designated individual to control the assets and care of a vulnerable adult who, because of age, disability, or incapacity, cannot act on their own behalf. These tools serve a purpose as long as the person assuming control acts in good faith for the benefit of the elderly individual. But there is a cost when the person assuming control, frequently a son or daughter of the elderly, uses these tools not to assist, but to exploit and abuse. Currently in Minnesota, it is all too easy for a trusted individual to exploit, abuse, and neglect a vulnerable adult, avoid detection, and profit from the crime. And Minnesota law offers little recourse or remedies to the victims of these unscrupulous individuals. My own experience serves as an example. When my mother was diagnosed as terminally ill, my older sister, who had previously persuaded my parents to name her as executor in their will, took control of the finances, medical care, and assets of our parents. She obtained the assistance of a certified National Academy of Elder Law attorney who notarized a power of attorney on behalf of my sister, apparently without witnessing my parents actually signing it, as the signature purported to be that of my father appears to be a forgery. Over the next 14 months, my sister proceeded to do the following. She transferred approximately $48,000 from my father's bank accounts into bank accounts or CDs under her name and those of two other siblings without the knowledge or permission of my father. She had my father's Social Security, pension, and interest income deposited into accounts in her name instead of my father's. She wrote checks to herself and her spouse from my parents' accounts totaling over $17,000 without providing credible documentation or receipts. She took and allowed others to take personal property belonging to my father without his knowledge or consent. She refused to provide an accounting to my father or myself, even though my father had previously signed a valid power of attorney on my behalf for the purpose of obtaining information concerning his finances. She then transferred my father from the assisted living facility preferred by my father and to which his physicians had referred him to a facility where she could maintain exclusive control over his care and administration of medications and isolate him from other family members and friends. When I petitioned the court to appoint a conservator in order to protect my father, she took him to a series of doctors in an unsuccessful attempt to obtain a diagnosis of terminal dementia. Over several months, she obtained prescriptions for increasing doses of psychotropic and other powerful drugs from several different doctors and pharmacies and refused to allow my father to consult medical professionals independent of her. Because of deafness, my father was particularly vulnerable and could not hear communications between my sister and the doctors, even when he was present. While I attempted to get the probate court to appoint an independent conservator to oversee the care of my father and the use of his assets, my sister and her attorney caused repeated delays in scheduling a court hearing. When the Ombudsman for Older Minnesotans attempted to investigate, he was denied access to the assisted living facility where my father resided. Within days of the Ombudsman's request to meet with my father's medical condition suddenly and unexpectedly deteriorated and he died of pneumonia attributed to drug toxicity. His death ended the investigation by the court-appointed attorney and the Ombudsman and made moot the order by his physicians to transfer him to a safer facility where staff could monitor his care. My petition, filed with the intent to protect my father, was never heard in court. The suspicious nature and timing of my father's death, as well as the wrongdoing that occurred prior to his death, could not be addressed. Once my father died, I lost all rights to obtain information or to act on his behalf. Those who abused, exploited, and neglected my father acquired, for all practical purposes, immunity from ever having to account for their actions. The reason is, under current Minnesota law, once an elderly person dies, only the personal representative of the estate has standing to initiate an investigation or act on behalf of the vulnerable adult. Other immediate family members, even the spouse and children, have no right to require an accounting or to obtain information, including medical records, independent of the personal representative of the estate. There's little hope of obtaining necessary information, much less justice, if the person who is named personal representative in the will is also the person who is suspected of abuse, exploitation, or neglect while acting as attorney in fact or as de facto conservator or guardian. After 4.5 years in probate court and the expenditure of over $60,000 trying to protect and then obtain justice for my father, the most the court could do under Minnesota law was order my sister to restore to the estate some of the assets I could prove she had taken from my father prior to his death and to reimburse from the estate a small portion of what it cost me to recover those assets for the estate. She and the others involved suffered no other consequences for their actions. My family, on the other hand, not only suffered significant financial loss, but the irreplaceable loss of time with my father and the privilege of caring for him. People have asked me why a seemingly intelligent, well-educated professional would intentionally inflict harm on another person. I cannot tell you why one child would lovingly care for an aging parent while another would abuse and exploit them. It was certainly not something either my parents or myself anticipated happening to our family. I am not suggesting the elimination of useful estate planning tools or the imposition of unnecessary burdens on those who truly want to care for their loved ones. What is urgently needed, however, is legislation to correct the deficiencies in current Minnesota law that prevent the legal system from dealing effectively with situations where abuse has occurred. The proposed legislations would accomplish the following: require that a person or entity that takes control of the assets or care of a vulnerable adult act for the benefit of the vulnerable adult, provide standing for interested persons to bring civil tort actions against the wrongdoer who has assumed responsibility for the care of a vulnerable adult on behalf of the elderly person who is being or has been neglected, abused, or exploited, provide that tort claims survive the death of the victim so that an interested person, in addition to the personal representative of the state, can bring a tort claim, and a claim pending prior to death is not extinguished by death. And it provides effective remedies, reducing the incentive to exploit, neglect, and harm those unable to protect themselves. Every delay in passing this bill puts more elderly at risk of abuse and premature death and denies justice to families. Other states, such as Arizona, have already enacted protections such as those proposed here. Minnesota's vulnerable adults and their loved ones deserve as much.
Thank you, Ms. Smith. Representative Scott, you have one more testifier, and somebody might have their cell phone on. Could everybody check? Please shut your cell phones off. That's what I think we're getting interference with.
Mr. Chair, there are a couple of other testifiers with their personal stories, and I think we'll have them go before we hear from the attorney that helped draft the bill.
Okay.
Joyce, Stewie.
Ms. Dewey,
yes.
Welcome to our committee. If you can identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm Joyce Dewey from Waconia. I would like to share my
testimony. Could you pull the microphone close to you so we can be sure it's...
I want to change seats.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm Joyce Dewey, and I'd like to share my personal testimony of what happened in our situation. Everything was done, it was said, pertaining to our father's estate to the letter of the law. It was all perfectly legal, we were told again and again. But taking one's property while taking advantage of a vulnerable adult, administering psychotic drugs, undue influence of manipulation and threats, and the changing of one's last wishes are not perfectly legal. The way the Minnesota law currently reads, the accused can use the legal system and the medical system to exploit and abuse. Under the current Minnesota law, there is no accountability for the responsible persons. In our situation, we were dealing with a second wife of our father. Somehow, because they were married for 22 years, that gave her credence to do what she did without anyone ever suspecting a thing. She used the town's elder law attorney and our doctor to obtain everything that her father had ever worked for herself, contrary to our father's wishes. Prior to our father's death, our stepmother did the following. Attempted to get sole power of attorney in 2008 when she was already POA since 2001, thus eliminating his son as co-POA. Had her father pull his retirement plan, which only he was a signer on, out of the bank he was with for 85 years and put it in Edward Jones. Our dad told us after this was done that he did not know where his money was or where she had put it. Beneficiaries were changed from his four children and stepmother to stepmother only. She shredded all documentation regarding 104 lots Dad developed. We have no idea where all this money went. She took Dad to his son's attorney in 2008 to make the amendment changes to the original 2001 trust. when the attorney called Dad's son to see if he thought his dad was competent enough to make these drastic changes, that attorney would not do it. So she then took Dad back to his original attorney and had him make all the changes and possibly changing his son Bob from trustee and personal rep. Documentation shows that our father was put on 4 different antidepressants, psychotic drugs, narcotic painkillers, and prescription sleeping pills within the year and up to the time of the 2008 trust changes. In less than 4 months after that, Dad is given a psychological evaluation claiming he had dementia and needed 24/7 care. In that 4 months after changing his trust, little did my father know that he would be in an Alzheimer's lockup unit. When our brother, as co-POA, requested a copy of our dad's trust, the lawyer would not give it to him. A month later, Dad is in the Alzheimer's lockup unit. After Dad passed away, we tried several times to obtain a copy of our father's trust, as well as his prenuptial agreement. The attorney refused to show us them, even though we were named beneficiaries in them. She continued to have the facility give Dad antipsychotic drugs, even after we were told by the director of clinical services that he should be weaned off them. We continued to ask the doctor to not give Dad the psychotic drugs, one of which the FDA had warned to not give to the elderly and dementia patients because it could be fatal. We were told that Dad's wife requested that he be kept on them. Undue influence played a major role in our father's situation. His second wife's threats to put him in a nursing home and statements that none of his children would take care of him were repeated by her again and again. A notarized statement from Ted and Char Barant, Dad's nephew and wife, confirmed the manipulation and abuse that was going on prior to her having Dad sign the amended trust. In this document, they attest to what she was doing to Dad prior to the trust changes and how she tried to turn him toward her children and away from his own. We were told by an RN that our stepmother attempted 3 times to have her notarize Dad's signature while he was in the Alzheimer's lockup unit. The RN said that she could not do it. She changed his direct deposit of Social Security to go immediately from his checking to his savings. She would then transfer the money to an account in her name only. Our brother, co-power of attorney, was consequently unable to see where Dad's money was being spent. She cashed in 2 life insurance policies for over $70,000 while Dad was still alive. One of these policies, she was not even listed as a beneficiary. None of this money was used for Dad's care. She spent it on herself, including a purchase of a $45,000 Lincoln. She fixed up their $600,000 home that she then put on the market. The greatest indignity she inflicted on Dad was to put him on medical assistance. If she had not taken his money, he would have had the funds to provide the care that he needed. He had never intended to have others pay for his care. Through manipulating of staff, she tried to control her visiting time with Dad. She quick claimed deed of the house to herself, which is part of the real estate in the trust. Our dad had intended that it be divided among his children. She also sold 96 acres of land, which was to be divided by his 4 children. We know what Dad's wishes were in his original 2001 trust because he had told our brother. Not one of these wishes were fulfilled. Our dad died in September of 2010, 4 days after being given a fentanyl patch, even though there was no indication of needing it. Once Dad died, we lost all rights to obtain any legal, medical, or financial documents. Under current Minnesota law, only his personal representative, his second wife, has the position to investigate on behalf of our dad, the one that is suspected of the vulnerable adult abuse and exploitation is the one who under our law can investigate. Dad's children are denied important information and the right to obtain justice. We are named beneficiaries in these trusts and are not able to obtain a copy of them. Dad's prenuptial agreement has also been refused to us. This law must be changed. How many more elderly people have to suffer and go through what our dad did for something is done? How many more elderly people are going to have to be victimized and abused this way, with the accused going unpunished and justice not served? Thank you.
Thank you. One more, Representative Scott.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Are Judy going to come forward?
Well, welcome to our committee. If you could identify yourself for our record, you may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and it's an honor to be here. I thank all of you for listening to my testimony. My name is Judy Luzage. I live in St. Paul, Minnesota. My mother, Edna Wiggin, was born on February 24, 1918. As a young woman, she was the United States National Speed Skating Champion in 1936 out of Como Park in St. Paul, Minnesota. While preparing for the 1940 Olympics, the war came and she was not able to attend. Instead, she remained in Minnesota and raised a family. In September of 2008, at the age of 90, Edna broke her leg and arm. After the injury was successfully treated at United Hospital in St. Paul, she was transferred to a nursing home for rehabilitation. Unfortunately, Edna did not receive the rehab services prescribed for her. I watched helplessly as my mother's mental and physical health began to deteriorate. In spite of the fact that my mother had given me power of attorney to handle her affairs and named me in her health care directive, my ability to exercise these rights was denied me when control of my mother's care and finances was turned over to Lutheran Social Service and decisions were made by their conservator and guardians. While in the nursing home under the control of the LSS guardian, my mother was drugged into a semi-comatose state and treated like a prisoner. She was denied visitors, even close friends and family members. Even I, her daughter, was only allowed visiting rights once a month for 45 minutes at a time and only accompanied by another person that I had to hire to pay $50 per visit to see my mother. Her hearing aids were taken away from her. She was confined to a wheelchair that immobilized her. She was deprived of physical and speech therapy. She was not allowed to eat or drink, but instead was given a GJ feeding tube. Eventually, my mother's J tube was removed. However, drugs that put her into a semi-conscious state were continually administered to her through her G tube. I observed numerous bruises on her face, head, and arms, but could not persuade the nursing home to admit her to the hospital for treatment of these injuries. She was not allowed to return to United Hospital to have the J tube replaced and a complete reevaluation of her feeding tube regimen by her radiologist. Numerous times, the radiologist contacted me to have my mother return for an evaluation. The radiologists were concerned since without a J-tube to accompany the G-feeding tube, my mother was extremely at risk for aspirated pneumonia. My mother cried and begged me to take her back home. Eventually, she was so drugged that she was unable to communicate with me. Edna would never go home again. 4 months before her death, the LSS guardian assigned to my mother changed the locks in my mother's home and turned off the utilities. Neither my mother nor myself were allowed into the house, even though we had both lived there prior to my mother's hospitalization. In August 2009, an article appeared in the Star and Trib concerning my mother. Shortly afterwards, she died. I was notified by the LSS guardian. When I arrived at the nursing home, I was not allowed in to see my dead mother. The medical doctor of the nursing home indicated that the cause of my mother's death was pneumonia. Because of numerous unanswered questions, I requested an autopsy, which was later performed. I live with the memory of the abuse and death of my mother, knowing that there was nothing I could do to prevent it, even though I desperately tried. My mother's money is gone. The guardian and conservator in charge of her finances have never fully disclosed how it was spent. There are lingering questions concerning her care and the cause of her death. In January 2010, shortly after my mother's death, one of the guardian conservators involved in my mother's case was convicted of embezzlement of over $100,000 from other vulnerable adults that they were in charge of. The nursing home has been shut down. Unfortunately, the legal environment that allowed the abuse to occur still exists. Situations such as mine will continue to occur as long as those who make a living by managing the care and finances of vulnerable adults can conceal their actions. Family and other interested persons should have the right to full disclosure, even if there is no probate. Those who abuse the elderly need to know they will be held accountable. I'm asking your support for HF424. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Lazak. Mr. Cardall, would you please introduce yourself and
yes,
proceed?
My name is Eric Cardall. I'm an attorney in the Minnesota Bar, and I've been practicing for about 20 years, and it's helpful, I think, to explain to the committee where I've gained experience in this area. In the mid-1990s,
Mr. Cardall, could you go a little closer to the microphone? Thank you.
Not to repeat myself, I think I'm speaking loud enough, but my name is Eric Cardall, and to introduce myself, I've been practicing since 1992, practicing law, and I think it's helpful to explain where I'm coming from with respect to my legal experience. In the mid-1990s, I joined a small law firm and started an estate planning practice, and I got referrals from financial advisors and brokers and maybe 200 people I did estate planning for, and they're basically in their 70s, 80s, and 90s. And I've grown with them, and that's the experience base that I'm testifying from. I do not represent a bank that provides trustee services. I do not represent professional fiduciaries, guardians, and conservators who provide services to the elderly. Where I'm coming from is representing old people, and I've seen my clients grow older and get vulnerable, and many of them die, and I've seen what happens when there's dysfunctionality. With respect to the testifiers, I appreciate the love these three daughters have shown to their parents, as I think we all should, but we also should recognize that there's a lot of dysfunctionality now in parent-child relationships, especially when parents get old, and you have broken families, and you have disputes. And I've seen those in the guardianship conservatorship court, and I've also seen those in the probate court. Now, the origins of this bill really came in a case where an awful case in Hennepin County District Court where I represented a daughter where two Arizona residents took from their biological mother, their father. They took possession of dad, he was in his 90s, and just took him to Arizona without consent of the long-standing wife. And we sued that out on a number of different grounds, and Judge Lloyd Zimmerman, the Hennepin County District Court, agreed because this gentleman was removed to Arizona that Arizona state law applied. And it made a huge difference because this law is modeled after the law in Arizona. If we had brought that case in Minnesota under Minnesota law, the remedies would not have been available to this Minnesota resident who was removed to Arizona. But because we had the Arizona law, the tortfeasors, the wrongdoers, were held accountable and a remedy was paid via settlement. And so that's how I became aware of the Arizona alternative to what we have. Now, Arizona, they market for elderly people, so I'm sure the reason why they have these very protective laws for elderly people is when they invite the Minnesotans and others down to Arizona, these old people, they want to protect them from exploitation and abuse. And now in Minnesota, as the number of elderly people grow, I think we should have similar protections for our elderly people. In the end, the bill is quite technical, but I'll explain it quickly section by section. The definitions, the important ones are that we're looking for people who participate in deception, exploitation, intimidation, and neglect. The duties would be on those people who actually take a position of trust, this is Section 2, to take a position of trust or provide care or supervise an elderly person. So when you start supervising a vulnerable elderly adult, you have then duties not to abuse them, not to exploit them. Subdivision 4 is very important, and this is a change, and that is, under Minnesota law, the person who can bring a claim to protect themselves under these circumstances would be the elderly person. But they're vulnerable. They may be impaired. Many of my clients have become impaired. You probably know elderly people that are impaired. How effective would they be at bringing an action against someone who has supervisory authority over the person, at bringing a lawsuit against the person exercising the supervisory authority? Not very good. And so the sentence, an interested person may commence a civil action in district court or probate court to obtain remedies on behalf of the incapacitated or vulnerable adult, means that any interested person, if they see a vulnerable adult being exploited financially or personally, can commence an action. This is missing in the current law. And if we're concerned about these people who are most vulnerable, we should allow interested persons to bring claims on their behalf to get people to knock it off. In some situations, as mentioned in the testifiers, the person who might want to help the vulnerable adult is denied access by the person providing the supervisory control. And so you don't even have access to the elderly person to line up a lawyer to represent them against the person with supervisory control. In Subdivision 5, an important provision here is that the statute of limitations does not extinguish at the time of death. So in these cases where there's been inadequate health care, exploitation prior to death, the statute of limitations should be extended, not time barred by the death, so that some accountability can be made and the message can go out to these people that they are going to be held accountable. For example, undue influence was mentioned. The penalty for being on the losing side of an undue influence case is you don't get the estate. But there's no penalty for causing all that trouble. And you know, that's the type of thing that is addressed through the statute. The remedies are severe, but I think they're appropriate as a deterrent to all people who would take control of elderly, vulnerable people and exploit them. So based on my experience, there's a gap in the law. In Arizona, they filled the gap. And fortunately for my clients in the Hennepin County District Court case, my client was removed to Phoenix, Arizona, not someplace in Minnesota, because those remedies wouldn't have been available. And so I believe that Minnesota should catch up with Arizona and fill this gap so that our vulnerable adults, while they're living, are protected. And then after they passed away, there can still be some sort of justice brought against anyone who exploited those elderly people. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cardall. Members, we'll take questions for the next, up to the next half hour or so, or as long as they go. But any questions? Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Excuse me, and Representative Scott, thanks for the bill. This is an odd role reversal because you're bringing a bill that has, you know, that is quite expansive, creating a new right to sue. It's got attorney's fees in it. I can't help myself. It does have an attorney fee provision in it, I'll note, with some irony, and treble damages and all the rest. But so I think that's great. I did see the letter from the Bar Association, though, asking some questions. And I don't know if Mr. Lake or anyone else is planning to testify or not. I don't know if he's here. But the letter does lay out some...
I understand they're not here, Representative.
Okay. Just some questions that I guess I'll channel or ask. Okay. Not planning to testify. So I guess the first question, and maybe, Mr. Cardell, you can help in some of these answers, too. Just looking on page one of the... Now, I'm looking at the... Have we put the DE amendment on yet? We did. Okay. So I'm looking at that. Then, so lines 1.10 and 1.12 have among the definitions of deception... failing to correct a false impression or making a promise that the person does not intend to perform. And the State Bar Association letter raises at least a concern. It's not opposition, but concern. It says, and I'm paraphrasing, but it says something like, look, there are situations, and some of us have been in this situation, where you're caring for or helping to care for someone who's compromised or disabled in some way, where you have to... engage in a little bit of game playing, maybe not to the length that you're talking about here, but I'm not doing the letter justice, and I can't find the specific spot here. Well, here it says, this is from the MSBA letter. It says, for example, caregivers dealing with the family member's dementia must sometimes purposely mislead the individual away from obsessive thinking in order to provide proper care. Obviously, the situations, the heartrending testimony we've heard today is not that situation, I understand. But do you think this could be maybe a little bit more narrowly tailored so that if anyone in this room is dealing with someone with dementia and maybe has to purposely mislead, they're not suddenly on the hook for treble damages and attorney's fees? Do you think maybe there's some way that we could? I know we're laying this over today, which is an opportunity maybe to just fine-tune it a little bit. Do you have any ideas along those lines?
Mr. Cardall.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't think it's a realistic concern. I understand this distinction between truth-telling and sort of white lies, but really the duty here relates to not injuring the vulnerable adult. So if the case can be shown that the white lie doesn't damage the adult, then there's exculpatory facts. If the white lie actually constitutes exploitation of the adult, either in a personal way or in a financial way, then it cannot be excused by the intent of the person who's making the white lie. And we see this a lot in elder abuse cases, that it's stated that the best interests of the elderly person are being kept in mind, but when there's exploitation, and there's misrepresentations of fact, then that's deception. So you'd have to have the deception plus the injury to have a lawsuit. If there's deception and the person's actually helped, as indicated in Representative Simon's question, then of course there'd be no lawsuit because the person has benefited.
Representative Simon.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I'm glad we're laying this over. That's something to think about. You make a good point. I think we could all come up with hypotheticals or scenarios where we'd come on both sides of that question. I hope you're right. The other question I would have is there a necessity then, in again, looking at 1.10, 1.12, really all those factors under B after 1.7, do you think we need to put any sort of state of mind qualifier in there? This isn't strict liability, right? Is there some sort of state of mind requirement that we can or should have in here?
That might be right.
Mr. Cardell.
Okay.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Mr. Simon raises a legitimate question with respect to the establishment of the definition of deception. Ought there be an intentionality requirement or something like that?
Okay.
Any further, Representative Simon?
I think one more.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, and again, I'm just really, I'm looking at the MSBA letter, really. One of the points that Mr. Lake and the MSBA makes here is that the list of people who are people or entities in a position of trust and confidence on line 2.21 of the DE and thereafter, mention is made in the letter of a joint tenant or tenant in common. And the question here is, essentially, I'm paraphrasing Mr. Lake, the question he seems to pose is that really fair? There are many instances where someone could be a joint tenant or tenant in common, even in an investment-type scenario where people are joint tenants or partners of some sort in a venture, and then suddenly they're on a hook on the hook here. Do you care to comment about that?
Mr. Cardell.
Yes, Representative Simon, I appreciate the question. And I understand the tone, and I think these things could be discussed, but I still think that it runs to whether there's been injury. And so the typically, and that's the technical bill, so the idea would be, how does it work when a tenant in common purchases the interest of the other tenant in common at the end of that person's life when they're vulnerable? The documents are signed, the interest is sold below market value, purchased at below market value, the person dies, and then the personal representative isn't interested in investigating the exploitation. Here this bill would provide an opportunity for anyone with an interest to bring that action. And this is the seriousness in which Arizona has approached these property relationships and vulnerable adults. And so I understand the concern, but I also think that the Minnesota State Bar Association got right, that this is pointed at egregious cases of financial exploitation. And so if you would imagine, we can narrow the bill, but the idea is to get those egregious cases, which can come from all different walks of life. In fact, we had one of the testifiers mentioned that a licensed guardian, licensed, bonded, and certified guardian, professional guardian, had an employee who absconded with funds from vulnerable adults. So you wouldn't want to assume that just because they're commercial transactions that everything's on the up and up.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Simon.
Sorry, just to follow up, and then more of a technical or legislative question. And forever, whoever wants to answer it, again, on the backside of Mr. Lake's letter on behalf of the Bar Association, he talks about a concern about assignability. He's concerned, or at least the organization is concerned, about making this assignable. Because if it's assignable as opposed to just survivable past death, which that certainly makes sense to me, but at least in the letter, mention is made of the fact that if you make it assignable, it could technically be, you could create kind of a market for these kinds of claims. Obviously, that's not your intention, but would you be open to some limiting language there to make sure that, we don't have we're not trading in these claims, essentially?
Mr. Cardell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I think that in the process, these things can be modified and changed. The intent here is that because the person bringing the claim does not benefit, it's the estate, let's say if they're alive, the estate of the person, or if they're dead, the estate of the person. So the benefit for financial exploitation goes to that person, or after the death, their estate. And so the idea of an interested party bringing the claim and then being able to assign it, there would not be any benefit to the person bringing the claim or to the assignee. It would be a concerned person who might be a relative, might be a community nurse, might be all sorts of different situations you can think of who an interested person might be that would bring the claim in order to restore the funds that have been absconded with.
Representative Simon.
I get what you're saying. I guess my final question is whether or not, Representative Scott, this is for you as well, you would be between the time that you get over and
if you're move the microphone away from your device or turn any text device or anything, move the microphone away or shut your device off if you can. That's where we're getting feedback from, I guess. Go ahead, Representative.
Mr. Chair, I was just going to ask whether the proponents and the author would be open to working maybe with the MSBA or others between now and whenever else it's picked up, because I think it's an important subject. It's, I think, a good starting framework here, and but there's just room for some maybe changes to some definitions.
Representative Scott, your comment
Mr.
for that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Simon, yes, we're planning on, that's the reason for holding it over, is to work with some interested parties. We've had a few people walk through our door, believe it or not, with concerns about the bill, and so we do want to make it the best bill possible so that it doesn't open it up for lawsuit abuse, but yet it does what we want it to do, and that people are held accountable for their actions.
Thanks.
Representative Hillstrom, then Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Scott, there is an entire group that's made up of like 153 groups and organizations and entity, the elder abuse group. Have you been working with them at all on this issue? They typically try to come to some consensus on big issues like this. Have you been working with them?
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Hillstrom. I'd have to look through my notes. Last year we met with one elder group, and I don't remember if it was the elder abuse folks or if it was an elder some other capacity, but we've worked with a couple of groups that we went through the bill with, but then since we dropped the bill this week, or not dropped the bill, but since the hearing was scheduled, we've heard from a few others, and we're more than open to working with anyone on this bill. So.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The reason why I'm asking is because, boy, for years and years, they've been working on definitions, and I noticed that your definitions aren't the same as the definitions that they've been working on, and there's even a proposal this year to change a definition, and your definition doesn't match that definition, and so ultimately, it makes for very bad law at the end when you have many different definitions in different directions. The second issue is much of these stories sound criminal to me. So I'm curious as to, is there something missing in the criminal statute to actually take care of this issue? Because, you know, ultimately, there might not be any money to recover, right? If the money's gone and the people don't have any, there might not be any money to recover. But listening to these stories, it sounds to me that there's been very criminal-type behavior.
Mr. Chair and
Representative Scott.
Representative Hillstrom, I'll let Eric address that after I just give a brief answer. That has been brought to our attention about the definitions, first of all, and I understand that Representative Gottwaltz is working on a bill that addresses some criminal charges in situations like this, so, and I wasn't aware of that until today, so I'll be, you know, he's just over my little corner neck of the woods up on the fourth floor, so I'll be talking with him about his bill, looking that over and see if there's anything that we can do to make sure that the two mesh well together.
Mr. Cardell?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, on the working together point, I hope this is ends up being a bipartisan bill. It was certainly intended that way. I like my elderly clients. I like old people. And that's where this came from. And then I ran across Eunice and the others. and it should be integrated with the other bills that you're describing. I'm not aware of them. I'm just aware of this one. But with, I think with respect to the criminal question, that's a really good one. And I think that my observations of working in the court and working with adult protection is that there is excellent personnel in the adult protection. There's excellent personnel in the courts. The probate referees are very good and very effective. And I just think this is an additional tool that would be used, and that this personnel would understand that tool and would be available for certain cases. The cases I'm thinking of are when the elderly vulnerable person is alive, and the current laws don't allow for these type of personal actions to be brought to court and resolve these issues. And again, a lot of these cases involve vulnerable adults who are being supervised by someone, and there isn't the representation of the vulnerable person's best interests, and all these don't fall into a criminal area. And adult protection has limited resources, understaffed and overworked, and so this fills that gap as well.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just by way of initial comment, looking at those definitions as mentioned by Representative Hillstrom, and I noticed that deception includes that making a promise that you don't intend to perform or, can't be performed. It just stood out at me because I got engaged in December, and I'm wondering if it falls under that category. but of course,
I hope somebody was watching.
Expectations are all subjective. And by the way, she was sitting up there, but she left, so I'm sure word of that will get back to her. Please don't tell her. My question is for the testifiers. Now, this is already covered under the trust provisions in 50, not already covered, but it's addressed by Chapter 501B. But I don't think I heard specifically of why that chapter is inadequate. I know there are severe consequences for not following through on your duties as a fiduciary. So why have we not been able to get those, and how would these changes make that different? That could potentially be a broad question. You could say, well, that's why we're bringing the bill. I understand that, but specifically in 501B, what is inadequate about it?
Mr. Cardell, is that a question for you?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Thank you, Representative Lesh. It's good to bring up the trust laws with respect to this statute. Most estate planning and financial transactions for vulnerable people don't involve attorneys, though. There are beneficiary designations. There's around-the-block trust, you sort of informal transfers among family members with an intention to later distribute it at death to other people. And so this statute goes broader than just trustees. It would also include anyone who's taken supervisory authority over some vulnerable person's assets. And so that's why it's broader. It covers these other people and does, in a way, Representative Lesh, hold them accountable in a way a trustee would. Now, this might be a surprise to someone who, I'm not a trustee, I'm just managing my mom's money, but there should be a surprise if they've exploited and stolen mom's money. A trustee would be held accountable. Why wouldn't an attorney, in fact, in the same way, or someone else? Now, again, the key here is that when the person with supervisory authority is operating under the power of attorney and stealing the vulnerable adult's money, normally it's the only person who would have a right to bring a claim would be the vulnerable adult. And this statute allows interested parties to bring the claim and stop the exploitation in its tracks. And so, and then further against trustees, in cases of egregious abuse, of course, we have the additional remedies here, that it's not just a matter of the trustee giving the money back, but under the statute, they may have to pay attorney fees and also punitive damages, depending on the severity of the circumstances. So in a case where $1 million is potentially taken, the bank is more than happy to put $1 million back, but ought there be some sort of punitive measure because the bank has allowed this problem to happen.
So, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this brings up the question then. So say there's no trust, and I've got an arrangement with my mom. to work things out for, and it's all oral, and I'm trying to take care of her as best I can, and I don't get along with, say, the nurse or the personal care attendant or something, and then it goes on, and for a while, according to the definitions section, interested person includes, under that chapter 524, anyone who has lived with mom for more than 6 months. And I don't see it as excluding a nurse or a personal care attendant. So that personal care attendant or that nurse can suddenly cause me some problems because he or she doesn't know the details of what I worked out with mom and suddenly has standing to sue me under this. Is that true?
Yes.
Mr. Cardell.
Mr. Chair, yes.
Okay. Was there any thought, Mr. Chair, and for the testifier, asked a question whether or not that was appropriate. I know that just that fact makes me a little nervous, wondering about who has standing. There are the testifiers I've heard up here. No one would question their standing to sue in that situation, their family members, their adult children. But I wonder about someone who would question whether he even has a stake in it, or maybe thinks they could potentially have a stake in it if they challenge and sue me for some kind of settlement.
Mr. Cardell.
Yes, thank you, Representative Lesh. With respect to the question, no, these daughters here that testified, with respect to their living parents, if there was a financially exploitative transaction, they wouldn't have standing. They could standing to bring a guardianship petition, but they wouldn't have standing to bring, you know, this targeted claim that the, you know, to use the example, the joint tenant stole 50% of the property from my dad. That type of targeted claim is possible. They would only have standing to bring a guardianship petition. In many cases, with respect to vulnerable adults, they don't need a guardianship. They have capacity. They've just been tricked or manipulated or coerced. And so why do we have to do a guardianship petition to have a guardian appointed to bring the claim against the exploiter? And so that's one part of the answer. The second part of the answer is, yeah, that could be trimmed. But I do think that any person, a healthcare professional, who would bring an action under this statute, my sense is dealing with the community nurses that I've seen respond to these kind of instances of exploitation in neighborhoods, that you can trust they're trying to get it right. That healthcare professionals care very deeply about the elderly generally, and they are the ones that I would see bringing the claims. If they don't care about the elderly, they're in the wrong profession, and they probably wouldn't be bringing these types of claims. And so I understand the desire to limit persons of standing, but we're trying to deal with just the most egregious cases. And I understand also, it was mentioned, the idea of lawsuit abuse, and of course that's possible with any statute like this. My hope, though, is that the good personnel in the court system will distinguish between the frivolous cases and the good ones. Thank you.
Representative Hillstrom, question to this point?
Yeah, Mr. Chair. So I was listening to your answer, and I was hearing stole, theft. I mean, those are the kinds of things that I was hearing. And so those really are criminal matters. So I really think that I hope we can really figure out where these two pieces really fit together, because if you're really talking about people stealing the money and people threatening and those kinds of things, those really are in the criminal side of the world. So,
and Representative Hillstrom and Mr. Cardell, and I heard the same thing you did. You can respond to both of us here. Are you? I mean, is part of the problem is that's your assumption, or that the witnesses that were here, that are testifiers, that's what they're alleging, but to make that allegation and get far enough down the line of the legal processes to prove it is where they aren't able to get. Until you get some stronger evidence, they maybe aren't going to charge them with criminal wrongdoing, or is it an apples and oranges issue? Respond to Representative Hillstrom. I'm just...
Mr. Chair, thank you for the question. The criminal law requires proof beyond a reasonable doubt, and criminal prosecutors in some of these situations hesitate And here, if there's financial exploitation under the civil standard, it would be preponderance of the evidence. So there would be additional actions brought beyond what would be criminally prosecuted. And this is appropriate because these are the most vulnerable people in our society. And the idea of the statute is to allow these additional cases to be brought that might not be brought. And again, adult protection, I think they do a very good job. This is just another tool when adult protection and the criminal and the county prosecutors aren't following up on cases that should be brought in court.
Representative Hellstrom, is that help?
Well, I hear the answer, Mr. Chair. I just hope we figure it out.
Okay. Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For Representative Scott or Mr. Cardall, is the language in the DE2 amendment the same as or substantially the same as the language that exists in Arizona law?
Mr. Chair,
Representative
Hillstrom, I didn't hear the last part of your question. I'm sorry.
Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question is the language in this bill as amended substantially the same as the language that currently exists in Arizona law?
I'll let Mr.
Representative.
Mr. Cardell? Yes, there have been substantial modifications, but that's where we started, and that's where it still is, more or less.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Cardell, how long has that been in law in Arizona? Do you know?
I think for a couple decades. The case that I was referencing was brought probably in 2000, and so it got resolved.
So, Mr. Chair, I'm assuming that there's some experience then with cases that would be tried under this statute in Arizona, and I'm wondering, I'm having a great deal of difficulty imagining how it would be possible to actually establish that someone had created or confirmed a false impression or that they failed to correct it. Are you aware of cases that have been based on these allegations, and how could such a thing be established?
One thing would be like receiving a check from an elderly person in exchange for some asset, then the asset isn't transferred.
But Mr. Chair, Mr. Cardall, how would you determine that was the intent in turning over the check?
Mr. Cardall?
A lot of these cases involve elderly people with capacity who are vulnerable. So if you'd imagine my clients being in a wheelchair, 100% capacity, but speaking with a soft voice, and they were coerced or told to sign a check, and they were expecting to get something in return, and then that's the check is made, cashed, and the thing in return is not delivered. So that would be an example of financial exploitation. And under those circumstances, you know, the person may not be capable of hiring an attorney and bringing a lawsuit, and the statute would allow an interested person to bring the claim. Of course, there could be a criminal prosecution, but you wouldn't want to wait for that because, well, you want to get the money back.
Representative Hilty?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cardall, I'm capable of imagining situations and such as you described that would work. But I'm also capable of imagining situations in which it's very difficult to imagine how it could work. For instance, if the vulnerable adult was not in possession of the mental capacity, and that the allegation that this deception was made came from the third party withstanding, how would you sort that out?
Mr. Cardell.
Thank you, Representative Hilty. I don't want to revisit the guardianship laws and conservatorship laws. There are procedures under guardianship and conservatorship laws for guardians and conservators to be appointed to deal with a lot of these issues. This statute would be a supplement to those statutes, and it would allow, with a proceeding to occur on behalf of the incapacitated person that wouldn't involve a guardianship petition. So it would deal with a single transaction or a single abusive situation. And so it would, in that instance, the statute would be used to reduce the amount of litigation rather than to expand it, because to appoint a guardian or conservator requires clear and convincing evidence of incapacity. Here, that wouldn't be required. You would just have to show that there was exploitation of a vulnerable adult. So that's an instance where you would have this litigation being a substitute for the process of getting a guardian appointed, having the guardian investigate the incident, and then having the guardian bring a lawsuit. So there you have two or three steps to having the incident, either personal injury or financial, litigated. And so in under those circumstances, this provides, it's not certainly not a silver bullet, but it's a more effective way to litigate certain circumstances.
Any follow-up, Representative Hilty?
No.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I also want to thank my brother and my sister for the care that they gave to my parents and saved me from any of this, much that I didn't know, the possibilities. This is my question for Representative Scott. You've got a series of questions from the Minnesota State Bar Association's technical feedback. And if this law has been in effect in Arizona, it's been based on that law. Have you seen this letter? Have you asked for answers from people who've used it for the last 20 years? Because, frankly, from the arguments today, there certainly seems to be a reason to do this bill. Whether it's the exact form that you've got it in, I don't know. But there's certainly good questions here, and we're getting some answers. Maybe an answer with a historical perspective might be more calming.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Scott.
And thanks for that question, Representative Mahoney. I didn't receive even word from the bar until yesterday, and I haven't even had a chance to read this letter, but that's one of the notes I wrote up here, was to check with Arizona, so I'll be doing that.
Any other questions, members, comments?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Scott.
I believe there's some folks in the audience that wanted to testify in opposition to this, or just to bring up some issues that they have with the bill. I wanted to give them the opportunity to come forward.
Okay. Is there anybody in the audience that wants to testify for or against? Raise your hand, and then we can get your name brought up here by the page.
Mr. Chair, maybe they left the building.
You convinced them.
Oh, yep.
come forward. Welcome to the committee. Identify yourself for the record, and are you raising opposition or concerns with the bill? Is that
concerns with the bill?
Okay. Identify yourself, please proceed and touch on them, and ultimately we'll ask you to work with the author and other members to work through some of these. But go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Stephen Grisham with Alternate Decision Makers Incorporated. We're a professional guardianship conservatorship agency here in Minnesota. A lot of the stories that I heard, all of the stories that I heard today, I have been involved with in a different setting, obviously, not with these individuals. And certainly that story is repeated day in and day out. That's why my company is in existence. When families do not get along, then the court appoints a third party to come in when there is allegations of misappropriation and financial exploitation. We work with adult protection. We work with several different police jurisdictions and with federal agencies as well as the state agencies in investigating financial exploitation. What is concerning in this bill and some of the language in this bill is that it opens up, as I believe Mr. Leash pointed out, am I going to be, as a professional guardian, when I'm trying to do my job, am I going to be sued by the nursing agency that I fire because I don't think that they're doing an adequate job, and they're going to come back at me? The assignability of some of the claims is also concerning because it does lend itself to opening up a market for this type of business for attorneys to pursue these claims. Having multiple people be able to file a lawsuit is concerning. We have some protection if we're appointed by the court in our job because we get an order to do just about everything we do. When we sell a house, we have to have a court order. When we do our accountings, they have to be approved by the court. But does this open it up to multiple lawsuits from multiple people? There are remedies already in existence, I believe, for a lot of the things that have been brought up today, because I've seen those remedies at work. So I think that we can work with Representative Scott on, I think that the bill has some very good intentions. I'm concerned about some unintended consequences that may occur, and I would like to work with her with on tweaking the bill, so to speak, so that we can, certainly people that do these type of crimes need to be prosecuted. There needs to be some more teeth. And I believe Mr. Cardall also pointed out that sometimes the prosecutors are not as aggressive as we would like for them to be. I've certainly had that experience where we've had things that were criminal, that we know that were criminal, but they were not prosecuted. The prosecutors are under the same burden, I guess, as adult protection and other agencies. They don't have the time, they don't have the money, they don't have the funds to pursue some of these instances of misappropriation. But I believe that the bill is, on its face value, has a lot of value, and we just look forward to working with Representative Scott to tweak some of the language and make this bill a bill that we can all work with, and it doesn't become overly burdensome to people such as myself in a professional capacity. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Grisham. Anybody else in the audience that would like to testify for or against this today? Nobody? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Grisham. Any questions for Mr. Grisham? Representative Scott, I'm going to ask this question because I don't know the answer to it. Maybe Mr. Cardell can answer it. A couple of the situations with alleged toxicology or drug toxicology as part of the death, wouldn't that allow a child to bring a potential wrongful death claim? And what am I missing if that's not allowed? Is that part of an answer that is out there, or is there more to a situation than that? If there's alleged wrongdoing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With respect to the wrongful death action, that's already provided for in statute, and so this would be a supplement. And with respect to misconduct that qualified, there would be an opportunity for additional causes of action. That's correct. So if there is an egregious situation, there could be a claim, egregious medical care situation where there was harm caused, that this would open the avenue to some claims beyond a wrongful death action. But the wrongful death action already exists.
And then the next, to connect that, if there's claim for that, you could get at some of these other questions through a deposition or discovery process, potentially, so long as it rationally or relates to the wrongful death. But is that an option that's in law now and could be used? And if so, why wouldn't it be used?
Currently, the statute of limitations is waived. The idea that the claim expires at the death is waived in wrongful death situations. So the reason why a wrongful death action can be brought is that there's an enacted statute saying that in those circumstances the claim doesn't die the claim doesn't expire at the death of the person. And I believe, and I'd have to check, but I do believe that personal injury claims also don't expire, but I have to go back and check. And so this is a supplement, and I guess the changes would be that it expands the types of claims that survive the death. So it's an augmentation to the wrongful death statute. It would allow other types of claims to go beyond the death. Further, the standing provision allows people other than the personal representative to commence a civil action in this regard.
Thank you, Mr. Cardell. Representative Scott, some final comments, and hopefully this has been helpful discussion and feedback.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Smith is back down here at the testify table, and she hasn't answered on that last question that you had regarding wrongful death. I leaned over and asked her if she'd ever filed wrongful death.
Ms. Smith.
Okay, yeah, Mr. Chairman. Yes, I did explore that, and in fact, I did speak with a number of attorneys that are involved with wrongful death suits, and the reason why it does not work for the elderly is because, I was told, the elderly have no economic value. It works, so there is no remedy. It works for children. It works for people who are in their, income, like a husband or a wife or whatever, where they have economic value. But the elderly have no economic value to somebody else there, and that's why that the wrongful death does not work. You can sue, but there's no remedy.
Very good. Thank you for that. Any further thoughts or comments, Representative Scott? Mr.
No,
Cardell?
Excuse me. I just have one. Mr. Grisham, who I know professionally, I really appreciated his testimony. While everyone's here, that the position of trust and confidence definition, maybe that could exclude court-appointed fiduciaries because they're under court supervision already. At least on the financial end, they can be surcharged as part of the accounting process for any exploitation. And just food for thought as we're revising the bill, because there you would indicate that, it shows that we're not trying to replace the guardianship conservatorship process, but if the guardian chooses not to investigate or conservator decides not to investigate some sort of exploitation, an interested party could bring that claim. You see how there's the backup.
Very good.
So thank you.
With that, I want to thank the three testifiers, Ms. Smith, Ms. Stewie, and Ms. Lasik. Thank you for coming in. Representative Scott, thank you for bringing this bill to our attention. I will let you work with the several different parties. Hopefully, you guys can work things out. Keep us posted with stuff over the next week or 10 days, and we can look at bringing this back if things can be worked out.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee.
With that, I'll formally move to lay this bill on the table. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The bill has been laid on the table. With that, members, the meeting is adjourned.